Hello and welcome to the Stubbscast, the Content Creator Hub podcast, where I interview many different creators in all different formats, from YouTubers, podcasters, devs, games industry members, and many more. We're back. Always mess things up. Right. If you want a cool gamer picture, like what I've got, or the Stubbscast layout you can see now, please check out the Graphic God at xboxgamerpix.com. And the Graphic God are more than happy to help you out. This week, I have former ex-Sony designer, Chris Gunnell. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Stubbs. Thanks for having me. I know we've been talking about this for a while, and various things have got kind of in the way both sides, so it's good to finally get to sit down and chat with you.
Yeah, no, it's been a while. It has, in the making. I've been doing it for over a year now, the Stubbscast. Not every week, though. Since January 2020. I've done over 40 interviews now. So apparently I've got a bit better. If you ever listen to my dealer one, you'll realise that I wasn't very experienced in interviewing back then compared to what I am now. So apparently I've learnt a bit, I have. But yeah, it's a good guy, dealer is. But yes, yeah, indeed. So, let's start at the beginning. What's your gaming history? How did you first get into gaming then? Memories?
Yeah, so, bloody hell, so a long while back. So when I was a kid, obviously, I'm one of two lads, so I've got a brother. My dad bought us consoles in kind of early days, so I think we had like an Atari original. I can never remember what the model is, like a 2700 or something. I need to double check. So proper early doors, like playing Pong and stuff. And then we moved quite quickly into kind of Acorns and then an Apple and then BBC's, Amigas, you name it. We had all kinds. So obviously on the BBC Micro and stuff was just playing around with like early coding and stuff. My uncle was kind of into computers at the time as well, and then moved up in the console. So we were fortunate because there were two of us, we kind of split what we wanted. So we got like a Master System and a NES, and then we got a SNES and a Mega Drive, and we always kind of asked for the other console so we could play. So we just it was just that, really. And then PC gaming took over. And that's when I really got into like the original Doom and used to like multiplayer by using old printer cables, you know, from one PC to another. It was like before networks and stuff. Serial cable.
Yeah, I remember at school, I knew nothing about computers or anything, but I remember one day all the, what I called the boffins that were computers, they all hooked up all the computers and were all playing Half-Life, it might have been.
Well, Doom was my first multiplayer experience with serial cables. Then we moved to like X-Wing versus TIE Fighter. On PC, I was really into like Falcon 4, which was like a flight sim. So I got into PCs that way and computers, and then I started building them myself before people even remotely built home PCs, because a mate of mine was basically like helping out us in the school that I was in, and he was helping IT out, and then we started like building machines and stuff. So I think from that age, I was into games, I was into tech, and then when I left school, I didn't really go on to like higher education in terms of like university stuff. I'd had enough of education and I wanted to just work, basically. I was into design and stuff at that time. And I started off as like a CAD operator. So like a trainee CAD operator,
designing like 2D
offices and stuff. So I was doing these like 2D drawings and stuff, converting them into computer. And I remember one day going into HMV. So HMV in the UK, for any US listeners, is like a It's a music voice. Games. Yeah, it's like a multiple entertainment shop, isn't it? Which has gone down the pan a bit now because like digital has kind of slowly killed it. But in Liverpool, they had this like it was like one of the biggest HMVs in the UK, and it was across like three stories. It was this huge like building, and Psygnosis were in there one day, and they were showcasing Wipeout. So they're showcasing the first Wipeout on big screens, and there was a few designers and whatnot in there. And me and my brother went in, played some Wipeout, and I was just kind of hooked. And like these guys were. Back then, I mean, this was probably 90 or something, 91, 92, whenever Wipeout was kind of being showcased. And you looked at these guys like they were kind of rock stars and stuff. I think game designers and developers then were driving around in Ferraris and all kinds if they were lucky. So it was like a really interesting time. And I was just, I was blown away by it. And I just wanted to get into the industry from then, sent a kind of speculative letter to Psygnosis, got brought in for an interview, and originally I started off in QA like a lot of people did back then. So it was like a tester, and then I moved quite quickly into technical testing, so testing all like the PC stuff, PC rigs and compatibility testing. So it was during like early Wipeout, it was Discworld 2, Crazy Ivan, G Police, you name it. It was all those kind of like early cool Psygnosis games, Destruction Derby, etc. And then just as I joined, Sony had bought Psygnosis. So they purchased Psygnosis and obviously started looking at turning them into like a PS, like a PlayStation studio, and then a job. I came up for a design in F1, and I live and breathe motorsport. I absolutely adore like Formula One and motorsport. Went for the job, obviously had the knowledge of the sport and got the job there. And then that was when my journey through like development started. So I started off as like a junior designer, then led some of the F1 series, then started working on Wipeout. And then, worked on all kinds of games, like went over to Sony Paris and stuff to help them with like Adidas Power Soccer and stuff like that in the early days. And then, ended up in Guerrilla Games, Killzone 2, came back to do a bit on Wipeout, and then we were doing other concepts. And then, the studio, it was in about my 14th year, Studio Liverpool basically got disbanded. And pretty much all the devs got laid off at the time. So a whirlwind express tour of like me getting into games, and then obviously my Sony journey. But obviously we can go into some detail about bits and bobs of Sony later on if you want.
No, definitely that's an interesting history. It's how you actually got in and you wrote a letter and they you got a job out of it.
They rejected me first letter and said, we'll keep you on file. And I thought, that's just a nice way of them saying thanks, but no thanks. And then 4 or 5 months later, they reached out to me and said, we've got some jobs. Do you want to come in for an interview? So it shows that it's worth sending a letter to places if you're interested. Yeah. And obviously, if they say they'll keep you on file, then hopefully they will.
Yeah, no, that's really good, that is. So, obviously, you say you're a games designer. What does that actually entail? Is it, like, character design, world building, or is it specific areas you do? Like say, for instance, F1, were you the guy that just made the cars, or is it helping the whole game, or is it specific areas, is it?
Yeah, so it's quite broad game design. So obviously you've got like level design, and you've got level designers may do like scripting and stuff like that, or you've got your traditional game designers, and some places nowadays will blur like a game designer with like a game director, depending on the development house. But essentially, if you take F1, I was kind of. There was me and a handful of other designers. I was looking at kind of AI, car handling. I was doing commentary scripts. I was recording commentary. You're obviously doing UX, UI kind of, you know, you're working with like an artist on UX, UI, making sure that things are kind of easy to navigate, user interface, etc. And then I was doing like replay cameras, different like game mechanics. So one of our F1 games, I introduced like this pit stop mechanic where like all of the four tires would be on L1, R1, L2 and R2, L2 and R2. So you do like the four shoulder buttons to change the tires. You press
so,
like
so it's quite they allow yeah, you so, to the, get involved in changing the creative process of the entire game then just by with games mechanics. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you that, put something forward. If it works. Yeah,
or if that's your position. So obviously as a lead designer, it's slightly different in terms of you're obviously making decisions, you know, you're writing design documents, but you're also kind of managing a team, you know. And I always used to say like game design was almost like, you know, 70% documentation writing, you know, you would do a good 10% of, you know, people managing. And obviously like 10% of hands-on and so on and so forth. So it's not, a lot of people had a misconception that you just kind of sat there and brain farted like a load of ideas and people just made it or whatever. Yeah. You know, there's a lot, there's a lot more to it.
It opened my eyes a bit because you know how obviously we've had, you know, Xbox acquisitions, everyone thinks games have just fall out their ass overnight. So my friend VJ, I don't know if you heard of him, he suggested I watch a documentary called Raising Kratos, the making of God of War.
Oh, yeah.
And that really opened my eyes to how difficult and hard and painstaking it really is, game development. Yeah. It's not as simple as it seems. And I know that was a tiny little sugar-coated thing, but I remember when they put all that hard work in and basically PlayStation came in and said, we don't like it. They were gutted. They were, you know.
Yeah, because you have to please your stakeholders and stuff. So, you know, we went through a period. Yeah. So after Killzone, we went through a period where we were doing game concepts. And the problem with game concepts is if you don't get through the green light process, and this is ultimately the demise of like Studio Liverpool with a few other things that happened at the time. But if you don't get through the green light process, you know, you're effectively... So 80-odd developers sat there not making any money because you're moving through like a cycle of concepts. So then the concept get rejected. You go through a cycle of like more concepts and you've got like 2, 3, 4 concepts on the go. And you've got like mini teams and stuff trying to make things happen. But obviously if the stakeholders turn around and say, "Joe, we don't want to make another Wipeout." Obviously, we as Studio Liverpool had lost the F1 license, lose it. It's just Sony didn't want to like rebid to it. And then it went to Codemasters. And then you get caught in like a concept cycle then. And ultimately, to Joe, the board and the powers that be in Japan, they'll just look at the studios and go, "Who's selling, Joe? What are the costs? Who's selling? Who's making money?" So, and if you get caught too long in a concept cycle, then you're essentially just a studio full of people that are costing money but not delivering anything. So you're not making that money back. And Sony kind of used to go through annual cycles anyway of like reducing staff counts and stuff anyway. You know, London would get hit, Cambridge, you know, Manchester got shut down. That always kind of happened. And I think each year you always kind of waited to see whether you were going to get like an envelope, you know, which is not like a good feeling. If you're in the middle if you're in the middle of a project which isn't launched, then you were pretty much safe. But if you were kind of in a fringe team or a team where the project had launched and you were kind of moving on to the next one, then you were always a bit worried that you would be the collateral in that regard. And Joe, Sony lost a lot of talented developers throughout the UK. And obviously business is business and you need to kind of like cycle or you need to kind of keep staff counts down. But it can be brutal sometimes. And then you've also got, like in any industry, so you've got big kind of characters, you've got big egos, you've got people like disagreeing. then you end up having kind of like infighting between, you know, what features should we do, what features shouldn't we do. So we didn't have any of that nonsense which is going on now, you know, like all sexism stuff and all of that.
It must be really, it must be really difficult to make a game now, because no matter what you do, someone will find something wrong with it, or there'll be a hate campaign against the game. You know, because people have got to remember, games are games. They're meant to be an escape from reality.
Yeah.
But now people want every game to be politically correct and everything has to be accurate, everything. It doesn't have to be. It's meant to be fun. It is. Games
are. Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, yeah, we used to get... I was going to say, we probably could have got away with more. Well, we did get away with more back in my day. But I mean, even, you know, we couldn't really have, like, big crashes and stuff in the F1 game, because like Formula One management would say, well, we don't want to see, you know, we don't want a game, you know, depicting drivers getting injured. And we were like, well, what if we show like the drivers getting out of the car? And then you'd just be back and forth in this like argument of, well, just don't show a crash anyway. And you're like, well, it's part and parcel of like the sport. So you'd have all these kind of arguments, you know, you couldn't have fire. It's like, we can't have fire, you know, full stop. The like, no chance you wouldn't be able to have like engines on fire and stuff. So you get caught, especially when you work with like a license, you get caught in some political decisions. I think that'll have eased a bit. Obviously, you know, crashes and stuff, you could have crashes to a certain degree. But yeah, you get caught in a lot of things, and there's a lot of disagreement. There's a lot of, as I say, there's a lot of kind of egos and personalities that clash, and you've got to work to kind of make sure that that doesn't consume the rest of the team and the job gets done at hand. So it can be difficult. And then the other thing for me is like, as I got towards the end of my 14 years, and Sony was shut down, so I had conversations with Ubisoft in Canada, EA. I had conversations with like a lot of different studios. I was looking at relocating, but I just kind of wanted a bit of a change at that point. Then I think I'd be so ingrained in games. The other thing it does, it kind of removes your enjoyment of games, because you kind of live and breathe so much throughout the day. The last thing you want to do is kind of go home and play a game again.
I have heard this, because obviously, I don't know if you spoke to VJ before. He's worked in many facets of the games industry for 25 years. He's not in it anymore. And he said that, because he's also got, I've spoke to his friend as well. He don't even play games anymore. He said, when you've been in the industry, a lot of people, when they leave the industry, they end up not playing video games anymore, because they're in it and they were behind the scenes, and it's obviously a job, but a lot of developers, once they get, some of them get out of it, because you've been in it for that long, they just don't like playing games in the end. Some of them, I'm not saying all developers like that, but I can imagine that, because you're in the industry, it's hard, you know what I mean? Or was it?
Yeah, the problem is you look at a game differently. So you can't help like look at it as a developer. So you kind of look at, and you end up inadvertently kind of going, oh, I would have done that differently, or I would have done this, and you're not being an arsehole about it, you know. But it's just ingrained in your head, because that's what you're doing kind of, you know, throughout the day. And sometimes, you know, you're working 10-hour days, 12-hour days, you know, should you wish. And I'm not talking about crunch and stuff. I'm talking about, you know, a lot of people like volunteer and stay in the office and you know, crack on and stuff, because you enjoy doing what you're doing. And we pulled some all-nighters and all kinds, and obviously got fed for it. And you'd have like a kip. You go to sleep in like one side of the room while people are working in the other, and then you have a couple of hours rest, and then you crack on again. But that wasn't like forced upon us. That was just people trying to use extra time to make the game better. But I think, you inadvertently, I suppose if you were, you know, if you were a mechanic, you would, or you build cars, you would get in a car and go, oh, I wouldn't have put the switches there or whatever. You know, it's just, it's just like anything. You can't help it. But I used to love games. Like, I love games now, but I used to love games. And then I went off them when I was a developer.
It's because you, It's because you took the magic away. That's why. You took the magic away.
Yeah, you don't get to see the finished article. You get to see like the mess, you know, throughout. Yeah. And sometimes you'll build the end of a game before you build the beginning. So you've got
Really? That's quite interesting.
Yeah, okay. You'll be looking at a game and you'll be finishing and you'll be seeing what the end game is, and you might be balancing that, and then you build a bit at the beginning and you build it in different chunks, or like the team split up builds in different chunks and you're in charge of like certain levels or this, that, the other. So by the time you get to it, you've obviously got loads of friends and people who are kind of wanting to jump on. So if we take Killzone, for example, people just wanted to play multiplayer. They were like, it's out now, let's play multiplayer and this, that, the other. And I just didn't want to touch it. You know, we'd played it for like 2 years. And everyone's like finding it out and enjoying it, and you're just bored of it, yeah? And then it's kind of hard to... It's hard to like motivate yourself in like an annual cycle as well. So when you're doing like F1, 2002, then 3, then 4, then 5, then 6, it's hard to, because you've got such a short development cycle, you then have to kind of stagger. So you finish 2003, you work on 4 and 5, and you try to do the bigger things for 5. But then you only end up getting the time to make small changes, and then you have people saying, oh, all you've done is put new cars in, and you've not really done, and you kind of try to explain that it's just time. So you can't get away from the lack of time, that's the problem. So it can can be tough at times, yeah?
Oh, no, I can imagine, because it's obviously the same concept. So you got F1 every year, football games every year, and to most people, the game looks... Obviously, to you can tell, but to a lot of gamers, they're not massive, massive upgrades. I mean, obviously, when you were doing F1... Each year, was there a lot of change, or was it literally the same game, just a little bit added? Or was there lot of changes?
No, it was time. And I mean, you were kind of forced into a couple of things. So, like, the major things that would happen is if they would introduce new circuits, you obviously got new car liveries and cars. So, your art teams had to do those. You were doing new commentary, but you were kind of recycling old commentary, but you'd have to go and have commentary sessions again to, like, record new driver names and stuff. And then you'd obviously add a bit more because you were like, oh, we were missing this, or we were missing that. And you were trying to add things. I mean, we started adding like career modes and stuff like that, but not to the extent of like Breaking Point that like Codemasters have got now, where they've got a much bigger team and they've been able to like create animated cutscenes and stuff like that. So a lot of those ideas like we wanted to do, but it was just the team wasn't really big enough to achieve that. You just get caught in cycles, really. Obviously, it was a welcome break moving over to Killzone. And Killzone 2 was a slightly different situation because obviously Sony had not long bought Guerrilla. Guerrilla were kind of in like the second or third year of like Killzone. And then that was not like a slight or anything on anyone at Guerrilla. I absolutely love the guys and girls at Guerrilla. But obviously Sony had spent a lot of money and they just wanted that game out. And they just it started to slip, and they started to chuck like, Cambridge were working on it as like an art studio, asset studio, Liverpool were working on it. A good chunk of us got sent over. Some were like AI programmers, myself, on the design team, they had no one on the kind of vehicle physics and stuff, for like the tanks and the jeeps and all that. That was all done with like Havoc, physics engines and stuff. So I went in and started setting up the vehicles, and then you obviously start working on balance and set up AI vehicles and stuff. So I think at one point there was hundreds and hundreds of people working on like Killzone across Europe. As I say, great studio. I was fortunate enough to work with some great developers. Obviously, Herman brought me in. He obviously running Guerrilla, so got to work under Herman and meet him. And He's obviously a great person. I've got a lot of respect for Herman. So that was like a welcome break. Obviously, I had to get acclimatized to like living in Amsterdam, moving away from like family and stuff at the time. So it was like a brilliant time, but it was also tough. I mean, during my time at Gorilla, I think I did, it must have been like over 150 odd flights. You know, I was flying in on a Monday, flying home on a Friday, and then staying in an apartment in Amsterdam for the week, and then, you know, flying back in Monday and just doing that over and over again. And then sometimes if I had holidays booked off, I'd fly home on like a Wednesday, and it was just insane. And then you start to realize, you know, how much money, and that's all on Sony's checkbook. And then you start realizing how much money Sony are paying. So we had like expenses to, because you obviously get expenses for like living in a different country. You've got an all expenses.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had an all expenses paid apartment in Amsterdam. A lot of the developers in Gorilla lived outside Amsterdam because it was expensive. We lived in like a really nice like townhouse, me and one other guy, Larry. He was an AI programmer, a good friend of mine. And so you're looking and you're thinking, so that's what, €2,500 a month for that apartment. We're getting like €50 a day allowance. Your flights are, you know, anywhere between 50 and 100 quid, like a flight. And then you start adding that up and saying there's like 15 people in Amsterdam from Liverpool. There's 10 or 15 in there from Cambridge. So you start to like think, how much is that as a project cost Sony? And obviously you can see why Sony wanted that kind of released as soon as they could.
Try and recoup some money.
Yeah,
you've also got to make sure it's a good product, or a game, I mean, as well. But that's why they were chucking so much money at it, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, and Gorilla before me and us, you know, being a part of Gorilla, had like a really hard task. Like I love Killzone 2, and I think it did like a lot of new things first. I think it was one of those games that had a real nice like point of view. We had, you know, really nice kind of like visual effects in, you know, decent story, some interesting like gunplay and stuff like that. But it was kind of touted as like the Halo killer, so it was really put a lot of pressure on everyone at Gorilla, you know, to try and it was supposed to be like Sony's Halo. You know, it was, right, let's elevate it to new heights. And I don't think that kind of, like, you know, the CG visual representation, which wasn't supposed to be, this is Killzone 2. This is actual Killzone 2, but a lot of people were, like, mistook it for that. Basically, what it was is, you know, like the R team and a third party kind of render studio, you know, did a trailer to capture what we were trying to, it was an easier way of visualizing what we were trying to capture, or what the team was trying to capture, in terms of like the field of view, you know, how the weapon moved and stuff like that. It wasn't supposed to be, this is actual gameplay footage, but it was obviously at a time where the lines were blurred. And obviously nowadays, you've got to have like a little line on everything saying this is an in-game footage and stuff, because
people have
tattooed and whatnot since then. So. Yeah,
they have to analyze every single frame, don't they? In case they see something, or think they've seen something, do they?
Well, I said something on Twitter last year, or when Miles Morales got released, and there was a TV advert, Miles Morales, and he put like these little like earbuds in, like these little headphones in, on the trailer.
Okay.
And it had small print saying the headbuds aren't available in the game. And it was just like, I posted something at the time saying,
what world are we in?
Like, you've got to say, like, these earbuds are not available in the game, you know, because someone's going to, like, sue Sony or something at some point. And that's the type of world that we live in now. If, like, you know, if a game character's got a red jacket on and then all of a sudden the game comes out and it's blue, you know, someone out there will clash action lawsuit the hell out of someone. It's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I'll just do a few shout outs, a few people.
Yeah, no worries.
Welcome to the Indie Gamer, Mr. Joanna Dark, The Darge Knight, Judd said the music. Thanks for stopping in, mate. I know you're not feeling too well, so I hope you get better soon. Misuku, welcome. Marion the Mad, cheers for stopping in. And anyone else? That's it so far. But yeah, thanks for popping in, everyone. But yeah, now you are right. Well, we got to effectively apologise because something's not going to be in the game that isn't real, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
How would you say, obviously you worked on F1, mm-hmm. how did that obviously differ from obviously working on a shooting game like Killzone 2? Was it a massively different way of working?
So I think for me, it was obviously different working with different nationalities. So obviously, predominantly with the Dutch, but obviously there was a lot of Italians, Germans, you know, you name it. It was quite multinational. Whereas like Studio Liverpool was obviously more, you know, UK based. There were a couple, there were a few Italians and Spanish and stuff like that, French, but it was predominantly kind of English speaking. I think slight difference in position because, towards the back end of, towards the back half of my kind of F1 development career, I was senior and lead designer on it. So you've got like a slightly different.
Senior lead designer.
You've got slightly different roles and responsibilities where you've got to kind of manage teams and stuff. Obviously, I was a senior designer on Killzone, but Guerrilla had its own kind of game directors and stuff, so you're working closely with them. I think in terms of actual... So other than like the different nationalities, obviously I got brought in because I had experience on car handling and stuff from F1, so I was brought in to do kind of vehicle physics and stuff because they didn't have anyone in the studio.
So was that the only role they let you do, or did they let you go further?
You obviously inadvertently end up like helping people out with like weapon balancing, you do multiplayer balancing, you get pulled into a lot of other things, and you're obviously doing different design documents and stuff. And then any of the levels which had like tanks in and stuff which I worked on, then you're obviously having input in how those levels perform, so on and so forth. Okay. So it's not just kind of like if it was purely set up vehicles. I mean, I'd set up like the Jeeps and stuff within like the first 2 weeks. I would have gone back home then, you get pulled into like other things then.
That explains it then. So when they say so-and-so worked on this at any studio, chances are they do a hell of a lot more than that as well.
Absolutely. And obviously there was certain people. So like one of the lads, Doug, he was the kind of weapons designer or the lead weapon designer. So he was balancing weapons and so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean he wasn't kind of like sanity checking stuff with me or, you know, Aaron or any of the other like designers, Matthias, who was the game director and stuff like that. So, you know, you all end up kind of chipping in. So Eric was like lead multiplayer with a guy called Simon and stuff. So there was, you end up kind of like tweaking and helping stuff. And then you may sit there and start to help kind of balance AI, so the AI programmers will be doing the actual programming of it, but you'll be making sure it's kind of working properly and making suggestions and stuff. So you get pulled into all kinds. So you effectively become a team player, and you all kind of work towards that goal of getting the product out in the best quality possible.
Yeah, no, it's good to hear. It's very interesting how you have different roles, and it's good to know, because beforehand, obviously, I'd no real insight into it. And I just thought when they come on and say, I'm the something, I worked on the weapons and that, and I just thought literally that was all they did. And obviously now you've explained to me that it's a lot more than that. You do a lot more, which is good. It is.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you work on any kind of multiplayer side? Any kind of, do you know how, like when you do multiplayer, when they have like fixes, or I suppose that wasn't your department really, was it? Because you're more in the designing field, did you?
Yeah, okay. So we worked on obviously F1 multiplayer, F1 and multiplayer in, Wipeout and multiplayer, Killzone had multiplayer. You know, effectively a designer will inadvertently become, you know, will be a tester as well, because you will be trying out the stuff that you're... So say, for example, I was setting up like the replay cameras on F1. You would set up replay cameras, you'd run through the replay cameras, then you'd run through different cars at different speeds, and you'd make sure that you weren't clipping any trees or trackside objects. And if you were, you would make adjustments, and then you'd try something slightly different. And so you're constantly kind of like creating, tweaking, testing, go through a cycle. And then if you think at the time, what was there? 18 or so tracks. So you're doing replay cameras for all those tracks. Then you're doing replay. Then you're doing actual in-game cameras for all the cars. So 10, 11, 12 teams. They've got slightly different, shaped cars and design cars. So you're doing like the T-cam, which is the camera above the driver that we see on telly most of the time.
Yeah.
Okay. That needs to be positioned slightly different. Then you're doing chase cams and you're doing look back cams and all of this stuff. So if you start to just take those two things, for example, you can see how that would be months and months and months of work.
Yeah.
To kind of,
it sounds it.
Kind of
it
get it right and, you know, tweak it and so on and so forth. So this is why kind of game development. And then the more complex the game, obviously, the more, you know, the higher number of those type of things you have, which become, you know, complex, like create, tweak. I mean, I was doing all the kind of AI balancing as well. So that was with like a lot of scripting. So effectively, you would have, a race line going around the track. So this is like the same for Wipeout as well as F1. So you'd have a race line going around the track, and then you would set the AI speeds, and you would set the AI speeds on like, you know, 100% on a straight. Then you would say it'd be like 20% on this straight, 30 on this, 40 on this, 45 on this. And you would kind of then race the AI. And if it was too easy, you'd start to like up them. And then you just have to keep tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it till it was kind of like a competitive race. Then you kind of take it beyond that. So you almost take it to a level where you can't really beat it, or you'd have to have like your perfect race to beat it, because it inevitably doesn't matter how good you are as developers and the amount of time that you spend with it. And I, like on F1, for example, I was like one of the best like drivers of the cars on it when we were having multiplayer and stuff like that. You would always take the AI even further, because you'd release the game and some ninja somewhere would like smash your lap times to bits. And you were kind of making the game like impossible pretty much for anyone internally. But then someone would be like, this is too easy. So you have to kind of balance beyond what's comfortable as well, which is always a tricky situation.
I'll tell you what, that's good to hear. Funny enough, I know someone that did that. You remember that game Hot Shot Racing?
Oh, yeah.
Indie game. Well, you know UK Dazzlers, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, at the time, when it came out, the game's got a Ghost Rider you've got to beat. Well, Daz kept beating it. He kept telling the developer he did. And they kept replying to him, because at the time, he kept beating it.
But no, yeah, well, that's what you've got to... Like on Wipeout, we had a trophy called... beat Zico or whatever. So Zico was like a coder who was like just amazing at this particular track. And we made a trophy out of it. And he was like impossible to beat. But people started beating him. And it was like, you'd have people out there getting these like beat Zico trophies and stuff. and we made it a trophy because it was like nigh on impossible to do. But people just started like beating it. And then you just think, when you think you're kind of at the pinnacle of your game, there's people out there who will just smash that to bits. Like, so you've got to bear that in mind. And obviously, there's more kind of complex ways now where, you know, you can have almost kind of like AI understanding how the player's racing. And, you know, you can almost have like a number of different versions of AI. So if a player's like consistently within this particular lap time, then you can automatically jump to like the next set of AI and so on and so forth. So there's more complex ways of doing things now. But then it was, you know, a lot of it started off with like just scripting and setting speeds and stuff. And then, so you'll play something. A good sign is you'll play something.
Yeah,
you'll play a racer game, and you'll be racing as fast as you can. And there will inevitably be a part of a track, and you will have either seen it or you will see it now because I tell you, you'll look for it. There'll inevitably be a part of a track where no matter what you do and how perfect you are, the AI's got more grip, is faster, something is different, and you're like, I just can't keep up with the AI there. That'll be the kind of scripting of the AI. And you cheat a bit with the AI where you know, when you're kind of setting scripting and stuff like that, you can kind of turn off the actual physics and driver model and stuff, because sometimes you'll push AI and it'll lose grip or it'll make a mistake or it'll spin off or something. And the only way you can correct that is by giving it an unrealistic amount of grip, or you can turn the actual car physics off so it like sticks to a track and stuff like that. You have to do a few of these like little cheats, so to speak, to make it look and appear like it's driving like a human. But you'll inevitably always see that. There's a section on Australia in the new F1 game, F1 2021, where no matter what I do, the AI grips more than it should be. And obviously, just because of my background, I'm kind of like, that's probably what's happening there.
Yeah.
Even on, kind of a lower set. So yeah, I mean, there's lots of little cheats and tweaks and all kinds that you can do on games to kind of make something look make something look as it should by, but it's not necessarily working at the same rules that the player has to abide by.
That's very interesting. I mean I do play racing games the odd time. I'm crap. I'm the kind of person you see drive into the wall when I go around the corner. I'm not very good, but even on easy mode, I struggle on the racing games. So,
it's not my thing. What are you playing at the minute then? What's your type of thing at the minute in the current? Obviously, there's a lot of games for us to jump on at the minute, isn't there? What are you spending time on?
At the minute, I'm doing a review for, I think, Into the Rays of Light. Can't remember. Very funny that. Into the Rays of Light or something. I can't remember. The Rays of Light, I think it's called. I'm playing that. Probably got a name wrong. Indy will probably correct me in a minute in the chat. Anyway, and I've bought Death's Door, which I have not played yet. And I'm playing the Halo Infinite preview. I'm liking
I'm going to jump on. I'm going to jump on that after this. I think Death's Door, I'm about 65% through, but it's one of those. I mean, so far it's like my game of the year, and I think it's one of those where, because I'm enjoying it so much, I'm purposely kind of playing it in chunks. And obviously, me and the Dark Knight in the chat, we started playing Death's Door at the same time.
Yeah,
and obviously comparing notes and kind of like bosses and stuff like that. But I'm enjoying it so much. I'm playing it in kind of like 45-minute chunks because I don't want it to be over. If you know what I mean. Do you know when you play a game that you really like, you don't want it to kind of get to the end. That's
that's when you know it's a good game, which is what you're, because it's sold something like 100,000 downloads in a week, and that's really good. So far,
it's over 400,000.
400,000. It's gone up.
Yeah, purchases now. Yeah, so it's
that's really good.
Obviously, for a studio which was two people, I think there was like three or four other people that were used for kind of art.
But they're dumbfounded. Dumbfounded. Their game's done that well.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Which is really good because.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it goes to show, if you've got like a passion, because these were like really passionate about, like classic Zeldas. And I think they were waiting for like Nintendo to release like a proper throwback Zelda. And then I think it didn't happen to their liking. So they just thought, we'll make our own. And it's obviously, they've made an incredible game.
Yeah, it does look it. I will get on it. I've also pre-ordered Song of Iron. That comes out 31st of August.
Oh,
that
yeah.
looks very good. But the indie games at the minute, they're just absolutely killing it. They are. They really are. And there's the Ascent. I've not played that.
Have you played it? I've not, to know.
It's downloaded. And there's also, I've not tried it yet, but the indie game was reviewed. Very, very good review. No spoilers in it. Omni as well.
He's oh, yeah, I've seen a few people talking about that.
And that looks very good as well. So at the minute, there's too many games to play. There is. There's too many.
Huge backlog. I've obviously played quite a bit of the Ascent. I was playing it with Colt as well last night. But he was like further than me. I just kind of jumped into his game. And then leveled up my character a little bit so we could, because I was obviously going up against like level 16 and stuff, and I was only like level 9 or 10 at the time. Sheer amount of detail in that game is unbelievable. I think the music's great. I think obviously the developers are working on, they're working on some patches at the moment because I know the PC version isn't using DLSS. I don't think it's got ray tracing on. The Game Pass version, I think it has on Steam, which is weird. And I think there's a DX12 like jitterbug, which the devs have come out and said they're working on. And I think, Joe, I think it's quite flawless in single player. I think in co-op, it's a little bit, it's got a few issues, but nothing that a couple of patches won't fix. But I think the detail, unbelievable amount of detail. And being a massive like Blade Runner fan and stuff, you know. It just feels like you're in that kind of Blade Runner, you know, environment. There's even like NPCs with like the neon umbrellas, you know, like out of the film Blade Runner and stuff.
Right. When you talk about these games, it means even more because you were in the field, so you know when a game's good, don't you? Yeah. Because
I was just going to say when you've got to give people a bit of like a little bit of slack, you know, a little bit of slack or whatever. I think there's too many. Exactly. I'll tell you one thing. There's absolutely no way in this world that it's a 3 out of 10, which Metro gave it. That's like the worst review I've ever seen anyone write. So Metro UK, obviously it's not like the greatest gaming publication in the world, but
they were the ones that said there's still a chance Starfield's coming to the PS5. They're really desperate, aren't they? They really are.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But it's not a 3 out of 10. No way. No. I mean, I don't think any game is really. No. You know? Well, I'll say the Dars again. Me and the Dars played that... is it called like Gang Beasts or something? Have you played it? It's almost like a Human Fall Flat thing, you know, like a little physics game.
Oh yeah, I played that with my son. We bought it ages ago, long before it came into Game Pass. Because my son watches YouTube, and if all these YouTubers like you've probably not heard of him, he's called Jelly. He's really big YouTuber, and he was playing Gang Beasts. I go, well, I can't get this on the console. So I looked. Oh no, I can get on the console. It's quite a fun game. It's a kids' game. It's quite fun. It is.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like a laugh, isn't it? And like me and Daj played it for, I'd say, 5 minutes, and it was just, it's one of those. You can imagine like having a few drinks and having a bit of a laugh with it and stuff.
Oh yeah, on the train when you're going on the train.
Yeah, we were sober. We just put it on to like see what it was like and. We put like 5 or 10 minutes into it, and it was kind of, we had a bit of a laugh, and then it was like, no, this is, you know, we weren't kind of feeling it or whatever. And I wouldn't have even give that like a 3 out of 10, with the experience I had. I'm not saying it's a rubbish game, but it just wasn't enjoyable for us. I can see going back to it, if there's more of you, it'll be a good laugh. But we were just obviously fighting like the AI and stuff like that. And it's like, so how can they give The Ascent a 3 out of 10? Which is like, it's just, it's bewildering. It's like, you know,
somebody doesn't 12 like indie people. Games. Someone that only likes AAA games or is a fanboy or something, I don't know.
Well, I think whoever reviewed it, because I don't think they named the reviewer, but whoever they reviewed it clearly doesn't play like Diablo-type games or whatever. So, and they were kind of...
Just play
All they kept saying is it's not Diablo, and it's like, but then they described very specific like Diablo gameplay mechanics, as being like repetitive and boring and rubbish and stuff. And it's like, we don't even play those type of games. So it's like me reviewing like a Final Fantasy. I do not get on with Final Fantasy games. I'm not like a JRPG fan or anything. I appreciate them and I understand why they're popular. I don't say anything bad about them. They're not my type of game, but I wouldn't go out and review it because I'm the wrong person to review that type of game. And I think Metro just shoves someone on it. There's no way in this world. It's a 3 out of 10, that's for sure.
No, I haven't even played it, and I don't know what to score it, but I'd imagine after playing it, it'd be quite a high score because it looks amazing.
I
think
I gave it an 8. Yeah. You know, when Colt asked me just off the cuff, said, "What would you give it?" After our couple of hours into it, I gave an 8, and then I played it yesterday with Colt a bit more. Still stand by the 8. I think there's a couple of bugs which you can get, which can be sorted. But just the sheer amount of detail and the actual gunplay for me is like so fun. And if you get a decent like co-op team together and you're kind of working together well and stuff. Obviously, if you jump in with someone who just runs off and doesn't stick with you, then that'll probably create a bit of an awkward situation. But no, it's awesome. I mean, just for the... Yeah, that's where I'd sit at. And there's a lot of people I spoke to who've got similar feelings. You know, obviously, Darj enjoys it. Zolka has been playing it, loves it. Colt does. There's loads of people have been playing it, saying how good it is. And a lot of people have actually been jumping on it, and it's been keeping them off, like, the Halo Infinite technical test as well.
Yeah, because that was one thing the indie game was on about. He says he hopes that a lot of the Ascent and Death Store doesn't get hit by people just playing Halo all weekend and forgetting about the good games that have just been released. So, but by the sounds of what you're saying, that's not happening. So, which is good.
I saw a lot of people on Twitter saying it's been keeping them off Halo. I mean, I haven't touched Halo. I touched it on, I think I played a little bit of it on the Friday or whatever day
You play against
bots. It's against bots, isn't it? Yeah.
And I tell you what, mate, they're fucking hard. These bots. They don't mess about, these bots, though. And apparently today, they've increased the difficulty of them. They're harder than the previous day.
I can't remember who it was on Twitter, but someone got like ninja'd by one of the bots. So they were like, whoever it was running after someone was melee attacking bots, followed one into like a little doorway and then into a walkway. Yeah. And the bot kind of jumped off a wall, like jumped behind him, did this like Neo move off the Matrix and then like killed the player. And he was just like, I can't believe I just absolutely got ninja'd by this bot. So it was kind of like led him into like a trap. And then just did like this jump move behind him and like killed him. It was like brilliant. It's awesome. Like I'll jump on and give it a blast after this, I think. But
I won't keep you much longer. Right. I just got another question. Obviously you use I don't know which graphics engines you were using. Do the studios keep you up to date, or do they put you on training courses to learn, say, if it was Unreal, or do you keep up to date with the latest teachings in Unreal or whatever graphics engines you used?
Yeah, so ours were different. So we had like proprietary in-house ones. Okay. So Studio Liverpool had two like immensely talented like engine programmers, probably two or three of them. So Wipeout was its own engine, F1 was its own engine. Okay. And tools that we used to use were like Mayer and stuff like that. So a lot of studios use like 3D Studio Max. And then obviously a lot of people who use engines. So towards the end of our life cycle with F1, we were starting to like investigate. Yeah. So some of our lead artists were starting to investigate like Unreal Engine and stuff. I think obviously I know a lot of people in the industry who work with Unreal and different engines and stuff. And they work quite closely with the providers of those engines, so they're getting constant updates. You have to bear in mind as well that studios will build their own plugins and stuff. So we used to have like our own plugins for Maya, which would do, they would kind of, we had like tools where you would basically create like splines for the tracks, and then it would put like a textured track layer and the side barriers up and stuff like that, you know, so you could have these tools that would do like auto extrude and things. But you build those yourself, and then as a studio, you've got to maintain those when the, you know, when any kind of 3D tools get updated and stuff, you know, it can break. And then, yeah, you keep on top of your engines, and obviously your actual level designers are the ones who are going to build like your environments with artists. And there's a few different ways in which like level design is done. So if it's kind of like Unreal or something, you will have like level designers who will build levels themselves with obviously assets that like the art team have built and put together, which are in keeping with the genre, you know, the type of art style that you're going for, etc. Or you will have areas where artists will build them in conjunction with level designers who basically say, we need multiple entry points here, we need multiple exit points, we need, you know, you can't have like a pinch point here, or you want a pinch point there, you know, to create like a little battle area and stuff like that. So it just depends on how the studio is set up, really, to, you know, who's kind of, whether artists are predominantly kind of asset building, like the kind of setting environments in terms of lighting and stuff like that. And then you've got level designers, you know, actual setting out those levels, or level designers blocking levels, and then artists come in and do the detail on top of them and stuff. But yeah, you'll constantly get updates for engines. You'll constantly be trying to update any custom tools. And then it's, you know, it's down to the development studios to make sure that any designers and stuff are staying, you know, upskilled and things like that, you know, depending on like the tools that you're using.
Were the tools fairly simple to use, or I presume they'd be easy, but they might not be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you had, you know, we as designers could design kind of like wipeout tracks using Maya and stuff, because we obviously had like plugins and tools. So I'm not a 3D artist by any stretch of the imagination, but I could use the tools to kind of spline out wipeout tracks. Obviously, lead designers on wipeout and stuff. We're building like a lot of tracks, and then artists were like populating the scenery and stuff. In terms of AI tools, you know, that was done in kind of Lua scripting and stuff, which is almost like similar to like a JavaScript type thing. So you would be doing Lua scripting on stuff. It just depends on like the tools that are being built. But, you know, a lot of it would be like text editors, or you'll have like editors that you've created yourself, or, you know, you'd do it in, you know, HTML, or, you know, whatever you're doing in certain things, and like importing into the right way. I mean, I did spend quite a bit of time getting into, so this is way back when I first started, I used to kind of build Quake levels and stuff in like World Builder. So I used to, but that was just like off my own bat, really. It was just something I wanted to get into. And I remember building like medieval scenes and stuff like that. So it is something like Unreal 5, and that is something that I'm going to sink my teeth back into. I mean, I think it was like the Indie Gamer, or it might have been someone else, was asking, you know, what it is I do now and stuff. And obviously, I've got like my own.
It was Judge Zilla. I was going to ask you that.
Oh, Judge Zilla, it was, yeah.
Yeah. What are you doing now? Because you're obviously not in, you obviously left the development scene.
So I did like a bit of consultancy when I decided like I didn't want to be in, I didn't want to go to like Canada, or, you know, work for like Ubisoft or anything. Was doing some consultancy. Then like I set up my own, I wanted to get into like different technologies. So I kind of set up my own like tech company, looking at, you know, like Android and iPhone apps, you know, way back when they were just kind of quite new. And then basically, long story short, like back in 2013, I started like Urban Zoo, which is a tech company that I've got now. And we basically built our own kind of proprietary platform, which obviously football clubs use. So we do website, app, content management system we built from the ground up, SSO, single sign-on, like data farm, and do all kinds of stuff like that. So we work with kind of 15, 16 football clubs in the UK at the moment. And then obviously we're working with many more. And this is kind of like the project that I'm on at the moment. But I did say to Judzilla, like, I'm working on a game concept again at the moment.
Oh, interesting.
Kind of like a tactical, like a third person tactical kind of co-op game, is all I'll kind of say on it at the moment.
Well, that's interesting. You're getting back into it a little bit.
I think once this project's over, whilst I'm in the process of this, like the Urban Zoo project and stuff, I'll either kind of start to work on a vertical slice of this game, obviously with a few people that I know, utilize, you know, some talent and stuff, to look at a vertical slice and then just see what the interest's like, and then take it from there. Or I'll complete this project that I'm working on at the minute and then look at, you know, kind of funding the development myself, you know, after this or whatnot. So definitely want to get back in games, but I want it to kind of be like on my own terms, if you know what I mean. So I've worked for myself and I've had my own business now for too long, whereas never say never, but I think it'd be quite difficult for me to go back to like working for someone, if that makes sense.
I don't know what you mean, because the way I work now, I was working in a factory for obviously somebody, but now I'm in the pest control field. It's not my own business, my dad's, but I'm a director, so one day will be passed over to me. So technically, I can. It's kind of like, apart from what jobs I've got to do, and that's about it. I can have whatever days off I want off. It's become more flexible, whereas before, when I worked for somebody, you couldn't just knock off at 2:30 to go and pick your kids up. I can now, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very different from working for someone as to having your own business.
Yeah, and you've got, you sometimes have like more exciting challenges as well. You know, I've got to ensure that, you know, there's 15 of us. I've got to ensure that like everyone is paying the mortgages and the bills, and a lot of those people have got kids, you know, so you've got those pressures. You obviously got the pressures of like growing the business. You're working with some, certainly in football, you're working with massive brands. A lot of people look up to football as a sport and stuff. So
I would ask you who, but I know you couldn't disclose them details.
I can. It's on the website or whatever. I'll give you a few. Work with Aston Villa.
Nice.
So work with Villa. Work with Everton. So your neck of the woods. Work with Everton.
I live 20 miles from Leicester.
Oh, okay. So yeah, a mate of mine's a Leicester fan. So you're a Leicester fan, or?
Yeah. Well, if I like football, would be more of a Leicester Tigers fan, more of a rugby fan.
Right. Rugby fan. like Stoke City, Wigan, So Celtic in Scotland, we work with Everton, Sheffield United, you name it. There's like loads. Obviously, other clubs. If anyone from the clubs are listening, and I haven't named them, it's not on purpose. I've like forgot how long the list is. I'm just trying to like keep it as short as possible.
And if you are listening, I'm really surprised you're listening.
Well, you never know, do you? They'll stumble across these things. But but it's like a different challenge. But the important thing is I'm still in tech. You know, I live and breathe tech. So we've built our own proprietary systems. You know, we've got our own like back end tech. We've got our own server tech. We've got, so all of these things that we're doing can be transferable to the game stuff that we want to do. There's a mixture of like really good talented people within the business who are interested in getting into games again and stuff like that. So it's not like it wouldn't be a drastic shift from what we're doing, but obviously when the time's right. But I think I've got a good idea, I've got a good concept, I think I've got something which is missing. It takes little kind of traits from games of the past, but they may not have been done that well, and I think a kind of like co-op tactical, third person kind of shooter is something that like a lot of people would enjoy. So I don't mean shooter in the sense that it's like a Call of Duty or something like that, but where you kind of two or three are controlling like squads of teams and stuff. So I almost think like a reimagination of Cannon Fodder meets Full Spectrum Warrior meets, you know, a number of different games or whatever. I think it'd be a really interesting.
It'd be a really interesting
game.
Well, you've piqued the indie gamer. Oh, interesting. He loves brilliant. People talking about indie games. He's working on projects, obviously. Judd Silla Music's got one for you. So it does sound like you're doing really well for yourself, mate. You want to be proud of what you created, your own brand, your own business. Plus the fact that you got Premier League teams on your books. That's got to be big, surely. You know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's proud to like work with a lot of these brands and stuff like that. So it's a challenging. It's like a really interesting sport, and it's a challenging sport as well, especially with like the pandemic and stuff. So you know, you're doing more with tech, and you're doing more online, and more ways of getting like fans to interact with the teams and stuff like that. So it's all good. I've just seen Judzilla's music question on the bottom. Yeah. I'm not sure, actually. I think a lot of studios, I think, would use their own. I honestly don't know. A lot of studios will use their own kind of, their own engines and their own kind of ways of utilizing sound and music design. But I think, I know studios are always interested in, grabbing decent, like, musicians and stuff for games. It's definitely worthwhile building up portfolios and then kind of hitting. All I'd say is like, just if you can, like a portfolio of like different genres or music types, or just pick a few games yourself and then overlay some soundtracks or sound work onto it. So but you look at like the music of Death Store, for example, absolutely stunning soundtrack. Not sure, who that is. I need to dig into it a bit, or how they've done that. But in terms of what systems they've used and stuff like that. But I always found that like people I know in the industry and stuff like that, I know like a lot of people will see jobs advertised and it'll be like, oh, you must be like a degree level this, and you've got to have this, and you've got to have that.
I've seen that. I have.
Yeah, and. Do you know all that is? Is that's a way of like kind of weeding out people who don't want to try, if that makes sense.
Okay. So if you're passionate about it and you've got the right skill set, but maybe not the qualification, they like you, you might get the job.
Yeah, I'd just say keep working on a portfolio. So if someone's interested in getting into like level design, live and breathe kind of Unreal Engine or something like that, and just start building scenes. So don't worry too much about building like a Call of Duty level or a Gears level or anything like that, but start build like little scenes, I would say. So build whatever, like a cabin in the woods if that's what you want to do, with like a really moody kind of lighting, or pick like a genre or a theme and build like a horror scene, build a damage scene, build a weather worn scene, and just start to like build up your portfolio. Think of your texturing, think of like the quality of finish, the best kind of render shots, and so on and so forth, and start to build a portfolio. And you send that portfolio to development teams, they will look at it, because they're always kind of looking out for people that they can bring in and mold into what they want. And if your portfolio is strong enough, it doesn't matter whether you've got a degree or not, they will jump on that. Even look at like the mod scene, start doing mods and that, or start trying to work in the mod scene. We've seen modern teams and stuff get picked up in the past. Valve have picked them up, Epic have picked people up. It's just all about your portfolio and your tools, really. We had guys coming up from QA who had just sat down and learned kind of Maya or 3D Studio Max or whatever. And they were just building cars after cars after cars after cars. And then before you know it, we brought them up. We promoted them from QA into the F1 team. Okay. They started building like cars. And then they went on to build, one of the lads I know, Dean, he went on to build cars in Forza for Playground and so on and so forth. So he was all self-taught himself. how to build cars, you know, looked at the best way to do it and stuff. So if you believe in your portfolio and just keep working on your portfolio, it doesn't matter if you've got zero experience on a game. If you find the right development studio, they'll give you a chance, because it's easier sometimes to get someone in who hasn't got this kind of like self-importance or this kind of ego about. Obviously, there's some people in the industry who are like superb, and you know, I don't think anyone should be egotistical, but you should be proud if you're good at what you do. So I'm not saying that, but you know, there's some developers out there who can't necessarily afford that type of individual.
Exactly. It costs
so money. Just someone with like real skill or an eye for it, or someone who's passionate about it, can in the end turn out to be, you know, that person that they're looking for.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice, Judd Zilla. That is there. Get writing some more music. Have you ever listened to his channel? He's really good at making music. He really
no,
is.
No, but I will do, because I love, yeah. Yeah, like I love any music genre. You know, I used to play around with Traktor and Fruity Loops and stuff myself, you know, just doing like...
Oh, I did back in the day, Fruity Loops, like, yeah. Cubase. Yeah. I actually done sound engineering in City and Guilds, but I never followed through with doing it as a job. I didn't in the end. But I used to mess about with all that stuff. Judd Zilla does make good music, and he's a bit modest. He'll tell you he's not very good at it, but he is. He's good at doing it.
If I'm not following him on Twitter, is his Twitter handle Judd Zilla Music, is it, or is it something different? Because there's some people that I come across in the chat, and I think I'm not following them, but I am. But so
yeah, he's changed it all to Judd Zilla Music now, so it's
easy.
Everyone knows who he, so he's easy to track now. He has.
Yeah,
apparently, Warmy Hood's enjoying the accents, apparently.
Oh, he does. He loves the old UK accents.
He does, but...
He's got to put up with, like, a Midlands accent and a Scouse accent. So that'll be interesting for everyone.
It will. But, yes, thanks for coming on. I've learned loads about what you're doing and what of your development history, which there were some interesting stories in there, and I learned a lot about actual development, about what goes into it, because as you say, it just doesn't happen overnight. Everyone seems to think, bought Bethesda, where's the new games?
Yeah,
you take years to make games, exactly, you know. But I've learned
it was complex enough in my day, and it's like even more complex now when people are dropping, like, you know, silly money, you know, 200-300 million on games and stuff like that. But it's like, I'm really passionate about it, and I think it's unfortunate that, you know, because, you know, on social media there's a lot of people who dislike me on the Sony side, because
I know some guy jumped in the tweet for this show, didn't they? And you were like, yeah, mate, I got in your head. Mine.
Yeah, it was I was blocked by him as well, and it's kind of like someone I've not interacted with. So basically, just before we go, like, a long story short, I obviously got insight into like what the new consoles were like, so I spoke about it, and the reason I spoke about it wasn't to flame any kind of wars, it was because
I remember the first time I heard you, time I heard about you, you were on Dealer's show, and then you started to put it on Wondering Dutch's show.
So I'm in the panel now for midweek.
Yeah. But that's where I first heard you, when all this new info was coming out. It's on Dealer's show. Sorry.
So I chipped in because there was a lot of like misinformation. And I chipped in and said, basically, you know, what I was being told by some of the devs is like there was a significant power difference or whatever. And a lot of people. A lot of people who were obviously in denial and didn't want to hear that jumped on me, tried to say it didn't work for Sony. I had like thousands and thousands of people looking at my LinkedIn profile to try and disprove me.
Wow, thousands. Seriously,
honest to God. So my LinkedIn blew up. I had people saying like my LinkedIn was false, and I even had like death threats and stuff like in the early days, which wow. some fanatics get a bit like crazy about, which was, you know, you just kind of like see it for what it is, like keyboard warriors. So there's a lot of people before we came on air, we were saying we didn't see any spoilers. You know, there's a lot of people I just blocked because
I don't want to
get involved in any like tiff or tat stuff. I mean, you know, Wilmy in the chat is, you know, a massive advocate for, you know,
if it's console
war stuff, then you're just getting like banned or whatever.
I think he's at like 88,000 now, isn't he?
I thought it was like 99,000 or something.
That's it, 99,000. You will break 100,000 this year, will
you? He probably has. Well, he probably has already. But so I just had like a load of people go after me, and it stopped. The reason it stopped is because I think IGN covered the RDX show and some of the stuff that I said. And obviously IGN did the digging to prove who I was before they obviously did the show. And I wasn't on it, but they obviously referenced RDX and they referenced some of the stuff I said, Ryan McCaffrey and that. And they obviously referenced that. I was with Studio Liverpool. And it literally stopped, you know. Days after that, people stopped hounding me. But it still goes on now. It's like that person who jumped on the chat. Oh, is it the same?
Yeah, Chris, who
was like slamming Sony and stuff. And it isn't. If you look through my stuff, I like and I share like Gorilla stuff. I'm followed by Insomniac. I'm followed by Insomniac Dev. So I speak highly of like Ratchet and Clank and you name it. So if there's something which you need to praise, it'll get praise. And I was also on Ryan's podcast, which is predominantly, you know, a PlayStation podcast. So, and, you know, that was really good. So if people actually take time to have an adult conversation, but if someone just starts spitting, like, it's anyone who goes, like, we. So if someone turns around and goes, like, we at PlayStation are the best console, that I'm like, you haven't got any shares. You know, you don't get
you're
paid.
You're a customer. You just got a plastic box. They don't really care about you. They just want your money.
Yeah. And it's the same on the other side. If someone's like, we at Xbox or, you know, we at Nintendo or I think, you know, there's a time and a place for adult conversation. If it just descends into like nonsense, like I posted a picture of, I don't know if you saw it, I posted a picture of a seaplane on Flight Sim. Some Sony fan jumped in and said it was a photo. It was a real photo. Basically said I was lying, even though it's got like the little really line at the top.
It's that good. It looks like a photo.
If you're thinking that it looks like a photo, then it shows you what everyone's saying when they say the game's good. So I think it's just unfortunate, but I think it exists. And then you have people who try to like spoil the Halo Infinite campaign and stuff like that, but luckily
because someone was like sharing it, block this account. So I typed in the Twitter account. Oh, I'd already blocked them.
Just to make sure I blocked them.
I did.
it's what you've got to do, isn't it? So Wilmy saying he's 617 away from 100,000 blocks.
Not long then. Not long.
Brilliant.
But yeah, no, I didn't realise that happened to you. I'm sorry that happened to you. It's sad that people are like that. It really is.
Like it's crazy. I mean, it was just like, you know, water off a duck's back for me because I'm like, you know, I did like a little bit of IP snooping. And it was someone in Canada, and it was someone in the US and stuff. So it was just like, am I really going to get a knock on my door? And they're going to follow through with like what they've said they were going to do to me and stuff. It's like, not really, am I? So you just kind of like block and move on, but it's ridiculous.
It is. But yeah, anyway, thanks for coming on. It's been a good, really good chat and insight, and by the sounds of it, a lot of people in the chat have learnt a bit too.
I appreciate you having me on, mate. I know we've been trying to do this, and obviously I just chat about this for hours and hours and hours, so I need kind of shut up sometimes. But obviously, if anyone wants to know anything, if anyone wants to chat about anything, you know, I'm on Twitter, CJ Grinnell, as it says in the bar at the bottom. Follow me, DM me, you know, whatever. I'm happy to speak to anyone about stuff if they want a genuine conversation about things. If they want to try and flame me, I'll just block them. So if that's what they want to do, they'll just get blocked. But yeah, if they want to talk about games or career development or any insight and stuff, so give us a shout. I've helped a few people on Twitter who actually like got into the industry and doing stuff now, like Tony Hart is one of them. So Tony Hart was one of them. He did some stuff with, you know, I think he's announced that he did some concept stuff with Playground and that, but he's like really talented concept artist. But he, I think like anything, he was kind of like, you know, why are they going to choose me and stuff? And I said, look, just keep speaking to people, keep asking them. And, you know, he got some work out of it and stuff. So it is worthwhile. And especially now we're so connected to like all these people on social media, it's much easier to kind of reach out to people, you know. You don't necessarily have to write a letter and get a rejection. We'll keep you on file. Response, yeah. You know, it's a lot easier and it's worthwhile. So, no, thanks for having me, mate. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. So, if you're listening on the podcast feeds, if you want to reach out to Chris, the links are in the description. He's just mentioned the links as well. He's told you where to follow him. Yeah, so it's been a really good conversation. And hopefully this podcast with Eat Voice in it helps some people get into the games industry. Or if you need more help, reach out to Chris. Now he's told you how to you can tweet him and get some more help if you need any. But yeah, thanks everyone. And thanks everyone for stopping by tonight. It's been a good one. Thanks, Chris, for coming on. And thanks to everyone in chat. It's been good.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Thanks, chat. Been great.
See you next time.